Welcome to the America's Workforce Radio Podcast, the flagship production of the American Workers Radio and Podcast Network, where organized labor and its never-ending fight to protect the rights of the American worker come first. Now, presented by LIUNA, Laborers International Union of North America, here's your host, Ed Flash Ferens.
Big court ruling for independent contractors in California. The Postal Service now saying they cannot guarantee ballots come Election Day. And today on the show, Ohio State Representative Tom Patton and an organization called Gig Workers Rising. Good afternoon and welcome to the Monday, August 17th edition of America's Workforce, where we are available on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, iHeartRadio, Spotify, online still at awfradio.com. We have two guests on the show today. Tom Patton, state representative of the great state of Ohio, will be joining us as our first guest. And one thing we're going to get into, there has been a shakeup in the House leadership in the state. Larry Householder, unfortunately, is a victim of an FBI raid several weeks back. He, along with several other individuals, now sitting in jail awaiting racketeering charges. As a result, we have a new speaker, and Tom is going to talk about that. Now, if you've been listening to this show for any duration, you know Larry Householder was very pro-labor. So what about the new guy? Robert Kupp is his name, and he's a former Ohio Supreme Court justice. And from what I understand, he's kind of neutral, but Tom is going to tell us all about it. He's also going to talk about the legislation, House Bill 6, which involves propping up two nuclear power plants as well as coal-fired plants. We'll see what the future holds for that legislation. Another piece of legislation is House Bill 308, and that concerns workers' compensation and disability retirement for peace officers, firefighters, and EMS workers diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. And this is when you contract PTSD arising from employment without an accompanying physical injury. So it could develop without getting injured on the job. And there's a lot of people in that category. Tom is very, very passionate on this issue. If you've been listening to him throughout this show, we've done several broadcasts on this specific issue. Later in the show, we have a newcomer. His name is Idan Alva. Idan Alva is with an organization called Gig Workers Rising. He originally immigrated to the United States from Israel. This was about 20 years ago. He currently lives in California, and for the past 6 years, he's been driving with Lyft. Well, 2 years ago, he became active in fighting for drivers' rights through Gig Workers Rising. And he did this as a driver, leader, and organizer. He's got a really interesting background, too. Before he immigrated to the United States, he was a military intelligence officer during his service with the Israeli Defense Force. Later served as a detective with the Israeli police. Israel's really interesting on how their citizenship evolves there. From what I understand, everybody pretty much has to go through the military there. And when you take a look at the conflicts in Israel over the years, you can probably see why they're going in that direction or have been going in that direction. So Idan Alva will be our second guest right here on America's Workforce. Speaking of which, this is very timely because Uber and Lyft suffered a major, major loss in court last week when a California state judge ruled that the ride-sharing companies must classify their drivers as employees rather than independent contractors. This fight has been going on for a long time. Now, California, the state of California, sued Uber and Lyft, arguing that the companies were in violation of AB 5, a landmark law passed last year, and that went into effect January 1 of this year, which makes it more difficult for employers to classify workers as independent contractors rather than employees. The court, in granting the injunction, that California sought ruled that Uber and Lyft were likely to lose on the merits of the case, pointing out the company's prolonged and brazen refusal to comply with the law. The court said that California showed an overwhelming likelihood that it could prove the companies were misclassifying drivers.
Wow.
The company said they will immediately appeal. And then over the weekend, Uber and Lyft threatened to pull out of the state. Yeah. Fascinating. In the meantime, and our second guest, Adan, is going to talk about that and more. Apparently, there is some legislation, not really legislation, a proposition, they call it in California. It's called Proposition 22. It's a ballot measure that would exempt companies like Uber and Lyft from AB5, that legislation we're talking about. It's never easy. It's never easy. This issue, though, is so reverberating with so many in labor today, especially like the Teamsters have been fighting this, because you have companies like FedEx who basically have truck drivers that are so-called independent contractors. You have to buy your own truck. And it may sound good, cool, that, hey, I got my own business, I'm driving my own truck. When you pay for the maintenance on the truck, insurance, you end up with like 20 grand a year. How do you live on that? There's a lot of people in that category today. So California is definitely taking the lead on this, no doubt about that. Plasters and cement masons, General President Daniel Stepano issued a blistering statement last week saying that President Trump and the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell have displayed, and this is a quote, an epic failure of leadership in walking away from the bargaining table and refusing to pass the HEROES Act. As you know, once again, keep talking about this. The House passed legislation to help so many workers that are out of a job because of the pandemic, and there's no budging on the Republican side. And this is what they said. On May 15th, the House passed the HEROES Act, extending $600 per week pandemic unemployment benefits through January, preserving health coverage for laid off workers, expanding testing and contact tracing, providing $1 trillion to keep state and local governments afloat, saving the post office, and requiring OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, to issue strong, enforceable COVID-19 workplace standards. In the nearly 3 months since, what have President Trump and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell done to turn this life-saving legislation into law? What have they done? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. In the meantime, and I'm sure you've been following this story, the Postal Service, on Friday, they sent letters to 46 states and the District of Columbia. So pretty much all of America, warning that they cannot guarantee all ballots cast by mail for the November election that will arrive on time to be counted. That is pretty scary. And this is even if people follow all the election rules in their respective state. Now, the Postal Service has been undergoing sweeping organizational and policy overhaul amid dire financial conditions. Cost-cutting moves have already delayed mail delivery by as much as a week in some areas. And check this, I didn't realize this. There's a decision that happened a couple of weeks ago to decommission 10% of the Postal Service's sorting machines. Why? This is like an automated process that saves time. Why would you do that? Rank and file postal workers, the unions are just absolutely furious on this. But last week, the letter carriers filed a grievance. We talked about that on the show. And they're pretty much saying the move is ill-timed and could sharply diminish the speedy processing of all mail, which is now happening. Some states are anticipating 10 times the normal volume of election mail. Six states and the District of Columbia receive warnings that ballots could be delayed for a narrow set of voters. But the Postal Service gave 40 other states, including battleground states like Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Florida, more serious warnings that their longstanding deadlines for requesting, returning, or counting ballots were incongruous. Hope I pronounced that correctly. With mail service, and that voters who send ballots in close to those deadlines may be disenfranchised. Hard to believe this is going on in America, but from what I understand, the House controlled by the Democrats, is calling all the officials together 1 week from today to try to get some answers on what is going on with our mail delivery in the United States of America. All right, we have to take a break. You're listening to America's Workforce. Our segment with Tom Patton coming up next. Don't go away.
This is America's Workforce.
LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, is the most progressive, aggressive, and fastest growing union of construction workers, and one of the most diverse and effective unions representing public service employees. LIUNA members are on the forefront of the construction industry, a sector that is a powerhouse of 12 million workers producing 5% of our country's economic output. A half million strong. We're united through collective bargaining agreements which help us earn family-supporting pay, good benefits, and the opportunity for advancement and better lives. With Mobile Action LIUNA, you can get updates on your cell phone, find out how to sign petitions, and download union ringtones. Be a part of your union's political and organizing efforts by sending a text message on your cell phone with the word LIUNA to the number 69866. Through the LIUNA Action Network, you can stay informed about your union with a one-minute update and action alerts.
America's workforce is being brought to you in part by the Communication Workers of America.
There is unity and strength for workers.
We are the USW.
We are the USW.
The United Steelworkers.
The largest industrial union in North America.
We represent 850,000 members in the U.S., Canada, and the Caribbean.
We work in metals,
rubber,
chemicals,
paper,
oil refining,
atomic energy, and the service sector.
We are steelworkers, standing strong and fighting for what's right.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And welcome back to America's Workforce, where we are available on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, iHeartRadio, Spotify. Please subscribe to our podcast, and we would appreciate a very good rating. 5 stars would be greatly appreciated. You can also follow us on Twitter. AWF Union Podcast is our Twitter handle. All right, let's go to line number one. By the way, this next segment brought to you in part by the North Coast Labor Federation, part of the AFL-CIO. Tom Patton joining us on line number one. He is an Ohio State representative, served in the Senate as well, and he's here to talk about a change of the guard, so to speak. In the state of Ohio, we had a much talked about raid, an FBI raid, about 3-4 weeks ago involving the Speaker of the House. And now we have a new Speaker of the House. And one of the things I'm sure a lot of people in organized labor are concerned about is the relationship that the new Speaker has with organized labor. Mr. Patton, welcome back to the show. Boy, you live in an interesting state right now. You know that.
The Chinese say, may you live in interesting times, but this is ridiculous, you know.
Yeah.
This is giant hornets, and then the whole bit coming. This has just been, this has been a year that I think we'll all be delighted to take the 2020 calendars and throw them out. You know, we just
Boy.
Can't wait for this year to be done.
You and me both. My guy, can't wait for this year to come to an end here. My gosh. All right, let's get into... The new guy here, Robert Kupp is his name. I remember he was on the Ohio Supreme Court for some time. And then all of a sudden with this Larry Householder scandal, Larry is sitting in jail right now. And the new speaker, give me a little background on him, because Larry was a friend of labor. There's no doubt about that. What about the new guy?
Oh, no. Yeah, no, I can assure you that Mr. Householder, at minimum, had a terrific hit. A couple of his sons were building trades guys, and I don't know if they helped kind of formulate his feelings towards the union trades and trade unionism as a whole. And
yeah.
So that was a blow to all of us, whose main concern, and as the union president, that's my concerns as well. To see this happen. However, I spoke with Mike Knifley, who's the state AFL-CIO building trades, the state building trades president. And he's from Lima, Ohio, as is a former justice and now speaker, Bob Kupp. And he's assured me, and this makes me feel better, he's assured me that over the years of their relationship, because Bob was in the Senate for many years, in the late 80s through the 90s, before he successfully ran and served several years on the Ohio Supreme Court. But they've always had very honest and very forthright discussions about the value of labor. And he's very comfortable, you know, with Bob Kupp on that. Now, I have not had the opportunity to sit down to the very brand new speaker, although I was delighted that one of his first acts was to reinstate me on the Finance Committee, which I had always been on prior to this General Assembly. And what's important about finance is that all the money spent in Ohio, for the most part, has to trickle through the Finance Committee. And so you want to be in that room. But I think that, you know, time will tell. Clearly, you know, Mr. Householder had a unbelievable commitment to the things that concern, you know, me and you, Flash, and to so many of the listeners, is that what are you going to do with prevailing wage? How are you going to block right-to-work efforts? And even project labor agreements, which is the other, you know, third part, because when you engage, when some of the towns and cities and mayors engage in these PLAs, you know, that assures the residents of those cities that the work's going to get done fairly, competitively, but done right the first time. And it's, I don't want to say it's a question mark. I was really satisfied after talking to Mike Knightley, you know, with that. He's confident with him, but, you know, obviously the proof's in the pudding. You know, I have fought a good fight for all those things I just mentioned, right to work, prevailing wage, Senate Bill 5, all that stuff. And, I need to be able to be confident, but I've also had speakers and Senate presidents who didn't necessarily agree with that. But we, then what we do is we try to work on my other members. You know, we had formed, In every General Assembly, I form what I call a labor coalition, you know, and we just have meetings. We talk about the value that labor brings and what value labor will bring to virtually everybody's district. Now, obviously, everybody's district isn't like Cuyahoga County. You've got some rural counties where, and we have a number. We have a significant number, sadly, of guys that just believe right to work is the way to go.
Right.
As we all call it, right to work for less. And one of the guys, you know, was running for speaker. You know, there was at one point a 5-person race for speaker to replace Speaker Householder. And one was clearly a very strong right. He introduced right to work again this year, even though Mr. Householder didn't let him give a, you have to give everybody an opportunity to introduce their bills that they introduce and give at least one hearing on it. And he waited pretty late into June before the guy, which is way too late to get a bill. Even you got to get in out of committee after 3 or 4 weeks. You know, if you can get the votes and then it's got to go to the floor. And then of course the speaker's a traffic cop. He decides what goes to the floor. And then even if it happens, you got to go to the other chamber. The clock just wasn't in their favor, but you know, again, as a sign, I think, of his support, you know, Speaker Householder kind of held up Riedel, Craig Riedel, who is the author of that. You know, and I think we need to just, you know, sit back, be vigilant, be tough, reelect Tom Patton until November because, I've spent, this is my 18th year, you know, and I have several union leaders who much more than I will do will extol my accomplishments with prevailing wage several years back. You know, there was a time that the governor Kasich wanted to bring it up to 3.5 million and Mr. Batchelder, then the House Speaker, said no, how about 1.5? And my own Senate president, realizing I had gathered a gaggle, he had said, well, how about 1.5? And I said, I have enough votes to keep it back at 87,000. And got up to leave the room with, at the time, the current building trades president. And he said, sit down, sit down. We ended up at 150 and 200 and finally 250. It had been changed in like 20 years. But it's still today. Mm-hmm. This is a vote we took in 2009 on prevailing wage. And that prevailing wage is still 250. You know, the building trades president then said 500 is great compared to 3.75 that Kasich wanted. And, you know, but he said, and then when he walked out, he was delirious. He was happy. He said, we can't build a house for 250, so 250 is great. And those are the kind of things you need to make sure you're there and accomplish and, you know, try to put people's focus on stuff more productive. You know, these are the, and I don't mean that, but at the end of the day, we can't escape the fact that this apparent, and again, I say apparent because everybody's got their day in court, but this apparent scandal, enough of which Mr. Householder was unanimously voted out as speaker. You know, so it wasn't that, you know, he had some detractors. There was enough, you know, evidence just in the indictment that they listed.
Yeah.
I think that forced the move and surprised me because I didn't think I had a great deal of respect for Mr. Householder as a leader. And this caught me completely blindsided. It did. So, but
everybody,
you know, what I tell everybody is this, I get to go to work, you know, every day when I go to Columbus, there's just a lot of people on both sides of the aisle that wake up every day saying, how do I make Ohio better today? You know, and they're not involved in such, because we're all scrutinized. We're all viewed, where do we get? We have to report who gives us a nickel for a donation. We have to report all the money, where we spend it. You know, we have photocopies of every check that comes out of your campaign account. They watch pretty close. But to the degree as it will unfold, that Mr. Householder and his group of apparent co-conspirators engaged was beyond the pale. We're not used to 501c4s, which I understand is a national, you know, the federal election. They play in that end of the pool. They usually don't play. I've not seen any election in Ohio that has had C014, which is undisclosed money, you know, come in and have such a great effect. You know, I actually haven't seen it come in at all. Clearly, it hasn't come in at my state Senate races or these state House races. So, we have to get campaign financing under control. And that's another, my good colleague and another person people have to return, a great friend of labor, is State Representative, former Senator Gail Manning from Lorain. Just a terrific supporter, a former union school teacher, but she's always been one of my allies. And she's introduced a bill, which I'm going to co-sponsor or add my name as a sponsor, because it's just about getting, you know, campaign financing under control, which is something that we owe to ourselves.
Yeah.
But also to the people of Ohio.
We need that on a national level, no doubt, no doubt.
Yeah.
All right, let's talk about the piece of legislation that brought all of this down, House Bill 6. Boy, I remember the campaign commercials. Wow, a lot of money spent. In fact, First Energy, the utility involved here, spent altogether, I believe, like $60 million. And you're asking, why would they spend $60 million? Because they're saving $1 billion. So when you look at the return on investment, I guess that makes some sense. Now, I remember having a conversation with you, Tom. You supported that legislation because it was keeping some nuclear power plants alive and operating, as well as some coal-fired plants, and we're talking about jobs. And I remember you saying that, okay, if we don't support them, then what it's going to do, it's going to diminish our energy supply, and rates will go up in respective areas.
I would vote for it today because of what the bill accomplished. The 2 years before that, before Mr. Householder became speaker, it wasn't House Bill 6, it was House Bill 139, and I signed up to be a co-sponsor to it. Really simply, we pay like $7 a month, and we've been paying $7 a month for the last dozen years or so for, I'm pretty sure that's the amount, for to be able to support wind and solar as subsidies. Every bill has that. Nobody realizes it, that they're taking a $5 bill and a couple singles and saying, here. And, you know, where I believe in, you know, we have to have some green energy. And I think when you look at, especially our younger people, our younger voters, they're looking for green energy. And, you know, anything you could do to provide that in a cost-effective manner. But, you know, you gave wind and solar in a state that candidly, by experts, say we are not a windy state. Believe it or not, we're listed as a partly cloudy state. So we're truly not even a solar state, but especially not the wind. How many times you drive by are the few windmills that we have that are standing absolutely still. The one at 40, I've seen move in 40 by Ridge Road. I haven't seen that one move in months. But, so what we substituted for that $7-some, whatever the amount is for the subsidies for wind and solar, and we transferred 85 cents to the nuclear plants, and that coal, those two coal plants, we get, you know, in order for us to get the uranium plant down in Ironton, Ohio, we had to provide a significant amount of coal for those plants, and the plant was one in Ohio, the other just over the Indiana border that a lot of Ohio workers across the border work at, but it was like a 25-year contract or so with the federal government to make sure that we would get that plant, you know, and that plant is based on coal burning. And so the coal industry in Ohio is in shatters. It can't compete with cheap natural gas. And no one was more excited, you know, except for those people that own property in Southeast Ohio, the Jed Clampets of the world that are now driving Cadillac Escalades. And God bless all those folks, you know. But, that cheap natural gas find has been a marvelous thing for us. But, you know, former Energy Secretary and Governor of Texas, Rick Perry, 4 years ago, sent all of us on the Public Utilities Committee a letter that said, you must have a diversified portfolio. You can't rely on coal or on cheap, you know, certainly not on wind and solar or nuclear. He didn't push anything, just push diversification. Because I'll give you this example. We have less than 2% of our energy in wind and solar. So that's almost a non-factor, no matter how much we subsidize it. And by the way, this bill, you know, has, I'm told so far, has saved the ratepayers $2.7 billion with the B dollars. That's $7 times every in Ohio some in the months that it's been out there, and will continue to save. You take away seven at 85 cents, you're $6-some ahead, you know, it seems every month. So that was one of the things we tried to accomplish, you know. But most importantly, if the nuclears go away and all you have left is cheap natural gas, the question I've always had is how long will the word cheap stay in the sentence? It won't.
Yeah.
It just can't. I mean, it's business. Now, you have at the corner of your street two gas stations. Bob's got one. Bill's got one. And you like Bill. You know, you like Bill a lot. And you pretty much go into him when his is $2.09 a gallon. The other one's $2.09 a gallon. And you like Bill a lot. But when Bob closes his gas station, even though you really use Bill, you know for a fact now that Bob, the only gas station in the area in the corner, that $2.09 is going to go to $2.34 because he doesn't have the guy across the street to compete with him. And we would be naive to think that that very same thing. So suddenly your electric bill is increased by 14%, you know, or 17% or 9%, or it's a multiple years where it's 14%, 9%, and suddenly your rates just continue to climb up. That's something that people overlook, because I will say this, granted, an obscene amount of money was spent, you know, through this organization that was concocted between Company A, you know, and read into what it was, I think we know by now who it was, but Company A and that team that Mr. Householder put together to ensure that they got it passed. But remember this, it went to the Ohio Senate, a great organization that I had the great honor and privilege to serve into, you know, and they passed that bill, okay, with slight modification, without any money being spent. The governor of the great state of Ohio signed the bill and candidly, you know, the day after the indictment said, but it's still a good bill. But then he came back and said, but we must repeal and replace it, because there's nothing that can be passed in Ohio, you know, that's got the stink of $61 million on it that we can let stand. I was one of the first to help sign up to co-sponsor a bill. Repeal it, come back, put all the facts on the table, Let the people that are opposed to it have their day in court, have them go in front of the people. But I think that if people take a look at the facts, and these are the facts, you know, we cannot count on wind and solar. We just can't. You know, it's just never going to produce enough power to truly affect the bottom. Candidly, it costs, as I said, currently before we eliminated those monthly subsidies, it was costing the people, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars as time going by, to the point now that LSC has told us $2.7 billion has been saved by the ratepayers since we eliminated those in favor of that 85 cents that will start in January, and that had a shelf life of only 7 years. After 7 years, the 85 cents goes away. You know, so, you know, it's a very complex situation. It can't be a good bill because of the fact that $61 million was funneled into an account to make sure the bill got passed. And then an ungodly amount of money. But having said that, you know, we take a look at the merits of what you tried to accomplish. Simply, you know, and yes, there's a lot of jobs in the nuclear industry that we're going to lose. There's got a good union jobs that are there as well. I mean, we had a lot of input and testimony from a lot of the trade unions that are employed there. And they're good paying jobs. You know, but that being said, you know, you only, if we could make the argument that at the very minimum, the nuclear power plants would keep the cheap natural gas in line. They would keep them from having a monopoly, at which time the electric bills would soar. I mean, that's, you know, I joke, Ray Charles is dead and blind, but he could see that one coming. You know, it's just my strong feeling. So I hope to repeal it, but I hope that we have the common sense to come back with some type of a bill that all parties are heard from to make sure that, you know, that those people who are opposed to it have the opportunity to stand up and say why they're opposed. And, you know, I wouldn't be against putting it on the ballot. I mean, I know that there was some of that $61 million spent to try to negate a possible vote by the people, you know, and they would have colored it, I think, in a bad way. They would have made the bill seem, you know, not, they would pick at the negatives and not underscore and underline the very, very positive things that a bill like that could produce for the ratepayers in Ohio.
Well, Tom, I appreciate your analogy of what went on here. I know there's a lot behind the scenes, and I'm sure more will be coming out, but I got to take a quick break. Tom Patton, state representative from the great state of Ohio, on our live line. Also coming up, gig workers rising, what Uber and Lyft drivers are doing out in California. It's all part of America's Workforce. Back in a few minutes.
You're listening to America's Workforce with Ed Flash Ferens.
The AFL-CIO is a proud sponsor of America's Workforce Radio. United by efforts to raise wages, listeners to this show and workers all across America are beginning to turn a corner and drive the economic debate. The AFL-CIO is comprised of 12.5 million working people from 56 unions, but we stand with and fight for everyone who is working for a better life. For more information about our raising wages agenda, go to aflcio.org.
Nurses, doctors, and caregivers at the VA are under attack. They face hostile management, callous agency heads, and an administration that's stomping all over their ability to speak up for our veterans. Unions are even being kicked out of their offices, a direct attempt to silence the voice of VA employees. When VA workers are under attack, veterans pay the price. Costly privatization and outsourcing will run rampant, meaning fewer services and worse quality of care for our nation's heroes. It's time to stand up for the workers who care for our veterans. Paid for by the American Federation of Government Employees.
Now, back to Ed Flash Ferens with America's Workforce.
And welcome back to America's Workforce. Don't forget we're available on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Twitter handle, AWF Union Podcast. Let's go back to our live line, button things up with Ohio State Representative Tom Patton. You've got some legislation that needs updating here. It's 308, and this is a very passionate issue for you. It's a post-traumatic stress disorder, especially those who are first responders. Maybe you can briefly tell us where we are with this, Tom. Go ahead.
Yeah, what we asked to do, the Supreme Court ruled that if you don't have a physical injury, you cannot have any type of a post-traumatic stress claim. And that's been something that has been on the books for a while. But yet we know that the police, fire, EMS workers, in the course of their career, will we'll see an average 7 traumatic things a week. A month, 7 things a month that they'll see. You and I and the normal people on the street, your listeners, will see 1 to 3 on average traumatic things in their lifetime. But yet these men and women are seeing 7 per month. And the one incident I point to in particular, last January, a 1-year female Cleveland police officer, went to a scene, car stolen, and they finally got the car stopped in East Cleveland, but right before they stopped the car, without anybody noticing it, as they turned the corner, they clipped this poor little 12-year-old girl, threw her in the bushes. And so it's policewoman who arrived later on the scene, helping to kind of patrol or police the area. She discovers this terribly mangled, the dead body of this 12-year-old girl. And 24 hours later, this woman commits suicide, this officer. I don't know if she had a 12-year-old daughter, 12-year-old niece or whatever, but it affected her so profoundly. And so many of these guys, we all know this is an undeniable fact. They lead the nation in divorce, in alcoholism, and it's just a terrible thing. We're only asking that they get treated. And we've even limited, in some cases, the treatment time for a year. We made sure so the cynics who say, well, they're going to try to get 2 pensions, a workers' comp pension, and then their police or fire pension. So we made sure that's not the case. This is simply something that if they need or seek help because they've seen too many things that have traumatized them, we've given them the chance to file a claim, be able to go in, get the treatment. We've had experts say, 3 or 4 visits to a specialist psychologist, some counseling, probably some medication, but we can make them good as new. We can get them back on the job without these horrors, without these nightmares. And we've passed it through the Ohio House. I've passed it when I was in the Senate blocked by the House, but I have had positive discussion with Senate President Alboff. We need to get this done before the end of the year, or as with the 2-year General Assembly, whatever doesn't get done now, this year, has to start all over again next year. And so I want to get this thing done. These are the people that protect us, and they see the things that we never would ever want to see. And we just have to make sure that those that are truly traumatized by it, get the counseling that they need.
Yeah, these are our heroes, and we cherish what they do each and every day, especially now in the middle of a pandemic. All right, Mr. Patton, you take care. Thank you for all the information, especially being on the side of labor, 100% on the side of labor. We appreciate that. You take care. We'll talk to you in a couple of months, okay?
Super. Thanks, Flash. Take care.
All right. We're going to take a quick break when we come back. Gig Workers Rising, organization out of California. They're fighting for Uber and Lyft drivers. It's all part of America's Workforce. Back in a few minutes.
This is America's Workforce. More shows available at awfradio.com.
LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, is the most progressive, aggressive, and fastest growing union of construction workers, and one of the most diverse and effective unions representing public service employees. LIUNA members are on the forefront of the construction industry, a sector that is a powerhouse of 12 million workers producing 5% of our country's economic output, 500,000 strong. We're united through collective bargaining agreements which help us earn family-supporting pay, good benefits, and the opportunity for advancement and better lives. With Mobile Action LIUNA, you can get updates on your cell phone, find out how to sign petitions, and download union ringtones. Be a part of your union's political and organizing efforts by sending a text message on your cell phone with the word LIUNA to the number 69866. Through the LIUNA Action Network, you can stay informed about your union with a 1-minute update and action alerts.
The Food and Drug Administration has recently reported that the heartburn medication Zantac is linked to cancer. Zantac has been linked to a variety of cancers, which include
bladder, colorectal, kidney, liver, pancreatic, and stomach. So if you or a loved one took Zantac and developed any of these types of cancer, you need to call Kelly and Ferraro. 216-575-0777. Let me repeat that number. 216-575-0777 for a free case review. You may be entitled to compensation from the drug manufacturer.
The United Auto Workers are one of the largest and most diverse unions in North America, with members in virtually every sector of the economy. Learn more about this proud sponsor of our program at UAW.org.
Now, back to Ed Flash Ferens with America's Workforce.
And welcome back to America's Workforce. Don't forget our Twitter handle is at AWF Union Podcast. You can follow us right there, AWF Union Podcast. Let's go to line number two. And welcome from California today, Idan Alva. Idan is originally from Israel. He immigrated to the United States almost 20 years ago, and he's been residing in Alameda, California ever since. For the past 6 years, he has been driving with Lyft. And a couple of years ago, he became very active in fighting for drivers' rights through an organization that we have referenced on the show several times called Gig Workers Rising. Mr. Alva, welcome to America's Workforce. Thanks for joining us today.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
So, talk to me about Gig Workers Rising. I'd like to hear your interpretation of this. I've heard about it. It sounds like a union, but it's not. It sounds like an activist group. Explain that part for me.
So, Gig Workers Rising is an advocacy group and a campaign that began in 2018 by a nonprofit called Working Partnerships, which is a nonprofit that leads collaborative campaigns for equality jobs, for healthy communities, and for equitable growth. Gig Workers Rising mission is to organize gig workers, people who work through apps, to fight for better working conditions and a pathway to a union. The term gig workers and the business model behind it was created by corporations as a way to get extremely cheap labor. What they did is purposefully to misclassify their workers as contractors, which they never were. And that enabled the corporations to pay workers less than minimum wage, deprive them of basic labor protections that are required by law, like health insurance, like disability insurance, unemployment insurance, or even refund of costs that are directly related to work and so on. Mm-hmm. Our initial goal was to make the public aware that this is going on. We wanted to change the whole narrative in the conversation about the gig economy. If you remember, up until 2 years ago, gig companies managed to present themselves as this cool, futuristic thing that solves problems. Disruption was actually a buzzword, and nobody gave much thought to what happens after the disruption. We added goals over time. We lobbied to pass Assembly Bill 5 in California, which is a legislation that was initiated by Assemblymember Lorena Gonzalez, and that defined more clearly who is an employee and who is a contractor. Mm-hmm. It makes it much more difficult for employers to misclassify their employees. Once Assembly Bill 5 became law, that happened in January this year, gig companies refused to acknowledge that it applies to them. So we advocated for the California government to enforce it. Attorney General Becerra in California went ahead and filed an injunction against Lyft and Uber to get them to follow the law immediately. That is going on. And then he also initiated a long-term lawsuit that is also going on. Since Lyft and Uber are likely to lose the court battle, they went and with other gig companies invested $110 million to create their own ballot measure in the upcoming elections. That is called Proposition 22. And that ballot measure would excuse them basically from AB5 and thereby from labor law that apply to any other business. we are talking here about a multi-billion dollar company or multi-billion dollar companies that are funding Proposition 22 in order to avoid obeying the law, in order to be able to pay drivers even less than they get paid right now, to deny drivers basic protections like sick leave, disability insurance, and so on, put drivers and passengers' health at risk. Drivers are not protected from discrimination or harassment under this proposition, and drivers cannot organize in a union under that proposition. And the thing that scares me most is that if it passes, there is practically no way to modify it. It requires 7/8 of the legislature to make a change.
Ooh.
So we are fighting against it and trying our best to make sure that it won't happen.
So what's your status now? Are you no longer an independent contractor now, even though this law is being challenged?
Right now, we are in a situation where, according to the law, we are employees, but Lyft and Uber refuse to follow the law. That's why the Attorney General is taking them to court to enforce the law.
Okay.
We need that to be clarified by the courts.
Let me ask you, how are things with this pandemic? I know California has been a hot spot here. And the very fact that you're independent contractors, or they try to keep you as independent contractors, that had to be a risk for you, because it would seem that you would have to provide your own safety equipment, masks, sanitizers, and things like that, because you're actually not an employer. That being said, I'm just wondering, are some of these essentials here being provided to you because of the occupation that you're in, driving people around who might have the virus?
Yeah, so unfortunately, that is one of the many problems with us being classified by the companies as independent contractors. They expect us to be responsible for our own protection and the passengers' protection. So not only are we paid less than minimum wage, and as it is, have a whole bunch of expenses from gas to car maintenance to all sorts of mishaps that happen when you drive hours and hours, and mechanical failures and so on. Now we also need to purchase our own disinfectants and protective gear and spend time disinfecting the cars in between rides and not get compensated for any of that, which makes the whole thing ridiculous. And these companies just keep getting richer and richer, and drivers are being driven constantly into poverty.
Yeah. When you say minimum wage, I mean, we're talking like, well, the national minimum wage is a little over $7 an hour. When you add up the time and the maintenance for the vehicles and all that kind of stuff, what do you end up usually making?
In the Bay Area, well, I live in the Bay Area in California, and that is one of the highest cost of living in the world, I believe. Minimum wage here is around $15. And okay, when I drive, I would say on average, I was getting $22 a day or something, an hour, sorry. I was getting roughly $22 an hour. And when you deduct things like gas costs, like maintenance, when you drive that much, you don't do maintenance every 6 months. You end up doing it like twice a month.
Sure.
When you deduct things like flat tires, like cracked windshields, like all the stuff that happens when you drive a lot, you end up with significantly below minimum wage. In the Bay Area, it's pretty much impossible to exist even on $15 an hour if you need to pay not only for those costs, but you need to have your own health insurance. You need to take care of your family, food on the table, and so on. It adds up, and it's unmanageable over time unless nothing bad ever happens to you. Every small thing can knock you off your feet, essentially.
So where are we with this fight? I've been reading that this is a nationwide thing. I mean, Uber and Lyft, they're all over the place. Very, very popular. I don't know how they are now, especially with the pandemic that we're in. But What can you speak to as far as getting more people involved in your plight here? I'm just wondering what needs to be done. And I know you've been talking to unions. I don't know if there's any specific ones, but I just want to take it to the next step. Where are we with that?
We are in both a fight in California and in a national fight, and really I would go as far as saying that it's an international fight as well. In California, as I mentioned, we are in legal battle, and hopefully we'll see some resolution soon coming from courts. Same process happened also in Massachusetts. I know that other states are considering doing the same and suing these companies. The UK is also in the same situation. Uber there went through several kind of challenges in court and lost each and every one of them so far. In Canada, the same thing is happening. I think that gradually things will change worldwide. I would say that California is the ground zero of the fight against these gig companies, partly because they physically exist here. That's where their headquarters are, and partly because California is very pro-labor, relatively speaking, in the United States. And that is the place where it is the most possibility in the United States to overturn these kind of oppressive corporations' behavior.
Now, have any of the unions come forward to assist in your fight here?
Yes. I mean, there are many unions that are involved in this fight. It's really the interest of all unions, because when you think about it, we're not just fighting here against Lyft or Uber. We are fighting an unparalleled corporate greed across the board. If gig companies manage to legalize their business model, it would spread in no time to conventional workplaces. You can take almost any industry out there and hire people for specific tasks through an app, effectively eliminating 100 years of workers' protections. Workers coming together through a union is really the only way to fight for workers' rights. And so that is what's happening. Unions are understanding that risk that they're facing, and they're definitely assisting and joining the fight along with the California Labor Federation. We have here the wealthiest people on earth who are treating the workforce like a disposable component of money-making machine. Right. And often governments are very hesitant or unwilling to enforce the law on them. People like Jeff Bezos, a man who earns roughly $10 billion dollars a month throughout this year, at least, is forcing his Amazon warehouse workforce to work in unprotected conditions while ignoring outbreaks of coronavirus as best he can. Someone like Elon Musk, who earns $500 million a day, disregarding guidance by county officials and forcing his workers to work, to go back to work in unsafe conditions, which resulted with a wave of the infections in his company, and the government did nothing to penalize him for that. So in places where the government is kind of too hesitant to do anything, unions are the only solution to step in and fight for workers' rights.
Amen, brother. Hey, Don, we're going to have to leave it on that note. Gig Workers Rising website is gigworkersrising.org, gigworkersrising.org. Twitter handle is @GigWorkersRise, @GigWorkersRise, if you want to join in this crusade. Well, you keep the faith, keep up the fight, and please keep in touch with us here on America's Workforce. You got a friend here, okay? And good luck to you.
Thanks for having me. Have a great day.
All right. Idan Alva of Gig Workers Rising. That's it for another edition of America's Workforce. Coming up tomorrow, the latest from the Ohio Federation of Teachers. Until then, all of you have a safe and wonderful day.
That concludes another episode of the America's Workforce Radio Podcast. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe so you never miss a show. America's Workforce is a production of Labor Tools and BMA Media Group. Find out more information online at labortools.com.